We're continuing today with Henry Bauer. The story of the denialists is as old as time, and isn't it great that through the information highway, tributaries of all sorts, and regarding Henry, the Society for Scientific Exploration, that we are able to get a well-rounded view of information. Henry Bauer is now retired professor emeritus of chemistry and science studies at Virginia Polytechnic Institute and past editor for the Journal of the Society for Scientific Exploration. He is a denialist, keeping that free intellectual marketplace of science populated with independent thinkers. I'm Robin Clare. Stay tuned. This is Tributaries. There is a universal concern over medical costs, obviously.
Yeah.
Do you think this universal concern will overthrow all of this eventually? It's like changing course on a huge ocean liner in the middle of the ocean, of course. You can't do it on a dime, but...
Well, I thought that what I talked about at the SSE meeting, that the mainstream research literature actually shows that... what we're doing in the way of drug treatment of cardiovascular disease and so on is misguided and ineffective. I thought that that would be pertinent, and I tried to get an op-ed into various places that the rising costs of medical treatment in the States, the problem could be largely actually solved if we stopped doing expensive drug treatment of no benefit. Well, I couldn't get it published. And the other thing is that the drug companies, it's not too much to say that they actually own Congress. So it's very difficult to see how any change in actual practice is going to come about.
Henry, let's use a few moments right now to have you reiterate some of those things you were talking about, because that's what drew me in and wanted to get you on the air. A lot of us are aware at this point that their numbers, for instance, keep changing. So what they're doing is, and we're talking about the high blood pressure or heart condition or cholesterol, they keep changing the numbers. And instead of having someone go in to see a doctor with a certain symptom, now automatic tests replace symptoms and they're saying, oh, well, you have a predisposition for something, so you better get on this drug right now. And a lot of people aren't aware that that's not necessarily a good thing for them to do. So maybe you could talk about the high blood pressure or cholesterol system, the cardiovascular that you were talking about.
Right. What was an eye-opener for me was to come across a report from the Institute of Medicine in 2010 called Evaluation of Biomarkers. They were looking at whether it is a valid measure of cardiovascular disease to be looking at blood pressure, cholesterol level, and things of that sort. And they concluded that none of those things actually measure the state of such a disease. And yet, all treatments are based on trying to change the level of these things, which are not themselves parallel with the disease. In other words, what we're doing is treating symptoms and we're not getting at causes. Statins are one example of that. The use of statins is based on the idea that it's a good idea to lower the level of cholesterol. Joel Kaufman, in a book called Malignant Medical Myths, produces mainstream data which showed that overall all-cause mortality is least amongst people whose overall cholesterol level is between 180 and 280. And yet nowadays the guidelines are to treat anybody who with 200 or even 180 to try and reduce it below that level. It's also well known that statins have as one side effect muscle weakness. And that's because they affect the energy-producing mechanisms in the body. There's a, something called ubiquinone or coenzyme Q10, which is an essential part of all energy-producing reactions, and statins interfere with the production of CoQ10. So everybody taking statins should be taking CoQ10 supplements, and yet the drug companies do not tell you that. There is an important historical book by Jeremy Green, who's an MD and a medical historian. The book is called Prescribing by Numbers, and it gives the history of how the practice of medicine has changed. It used to be, if you felt ill, you went to the doctor and he examined you and tried to figure out what was wrong. Nowadays, you go to the doctor periodically and tests are done looking at your numbers. We're being told to know our numbers all the time. The result of that is that we are being treated for things when there's nothing wrong with us. And blood pressure is an outstanding example of that. Spacedoc.com is a website by Dr. Graveline, who was one of the medicos in the space program. And he himself was taking statins for a while and found that he lost his memory. And he published a book called Lipitor, The Thief of Memory. But he also has a historical write-up about blood pressure. After it became routine to measure blood pressure, it became obvious that blood pressure increases with age. And the rule of thumb was that normal blood pressure is about 100 plus your age. Extraordinarily enough, official guidelines nowadays define hypertension. In other words, your blood pressure is too high. They define hypertension without any recognition that it normally increases with age. So you have, if your blood pressure is above about 140 systolic, you're said to have hypertension, and yet that is the pressure that is normal for the average adult in middle age. And by the time we're 60 or 65, our average normal pressure is about 160, with the result that under the present definition, about four-fifths of all American seniors suffer from hypertension, supposedly, even if they don't feel ill in any way at all. So we are giving pressure-lowering medication to hordes of people who are perfectly healthy. And the results of this are yet to be fully appreciated. Jeremy Green also points out that when diuretics were first being introduced as a way of lowering blood pressure, many cardiologists objected to that and said, look, the increase in blood pressure with age is normal, and it may be a necessary compensation for the fact that arteries and veins are becoming less flexible, which means that more pressure is needed to send the blood to all of the organs and extremities where it's needed.
That's the common sense of it all, certainly.
Right. And in those days, the cardiologists had common sense.
All of this brings up such an interesting point. How do you see or recommend considering the difference between disease and old age, either be treated or even defined?
There's a wonderful article by a geriatrician that I came across who said that the challenges of old age are not medical, they're spiritual.
Mm.
It is normal as we age that our capabilities change in ways that may not be very pleasant. But medication is not an appropriate response to that. He said, what do you do if you have a patient where every test that you carry out shows some sort of an abnormality? And he said, and that's what you find typically with older people. If you do lots of tests on an older person, you will find that many of their physiological variables are different from what they were when they were 20 or 40 years of age. But that doesn't necessarily mean that this is something that you must treat. I mean, one of the overall illogicalities is also to treat every individual as though their numbers should correspond to some population average. This makes no sense at all. We know that people differ in their genetic predispositions, so it may well be that some people require a blood pressure of 180 in order to function properly, and others require a blood pressure of 70 to function properly. Why should we assume that they all have to be the same? And the same with the different cholesterol levels and all the other things that we measure nowadays.
Another piece of all of this that I would like to hear you speak of just a bit would be the drug repositioning that goes on. And that just compounds all of this problem, doesn't it?
Yes. The term side effect presumes that you can have a drug that does exactly what you want, and anything else that is done, that it does by chance, or it's not important, or whatever. Well, several years ago, someone sent me an article on drug repositioning that I found extraordinary. The drug companies, once they've had a drug approved, then spend a considerable amount of time looking for other conditions that drug might be used to treat.
It's not necessary for them to test it out as much once it gets an initial approval.
Yeah, the reason why they do that is that having a drug approved, it goes through two stages. The first stage is you have to establish that it's safe. And the second, you have to establish that it works against the particular condition. Well, once a drug has been approved for anything, to the FDA's satisfaction, it has been proven to be safe. So if the drug company can reposition it for some other use, it no longer has to go through the proof of safety, which can be a very lengthy process. So we find an increasing tendency for drug companies to try to have drugs which were approved for one thing approved for something else. And I mentioned, I think, in the talk, Cymbalta, which was already approved for half a dozen different things and then was repositioned to treat stress urinary incontinence, which didn't even, nothing connected with that had even appeared in the original side effects. And most amusing, perhaps, if you have that sort of sense of humor, is that if you look at the various side effects that have been reported for Cymbalta, they can be all over the place. It may cause constipation, but it can also cause diarrhea, which is the opposite. And it may cause difficulty in urinating, but it can also produce increased urination. So the drugs that are being marketed typically have many different functions in the body. And the importance of the so-called side effects has been greatly, greatly ignored, sadly ignored, as in the case of statins, for example, where, the muscle weakness comes from a known effect of the statin in affecting coenzyme Q10 production.
Yes, and in hearing you speak about all this, it's once again kind of funny, depending where your humor comes from, but it does, it calls its own self into question by the fact that one person will have this effect, another one will have another one, which is the total opposite. And it just answers that question, how can you treat someone by these averaging of numbers? The answer is you can't. It's not a valid system, and I'm so happy that we're able to share this information with however many people are listening because they can pass it along.
Right. I think the ultimate lesson is that you just cannot trust nowadays what you're hearing from official sources, including about medicine, and quite well-placed people have said that. Marcia Angel, who was a former editor of the New England Journal of Medicine, a couple of years ago in a book review in the New York Review of Books, said that she had come to the unfortunate conclusion that you cannot believe anything that is nowadays published as part of medical science. That's an extraordinary comment to come from someone with her history, an MD who has been prominent in editing and medical publishing for a long time.
Yeah, so it just begs that if anyone is seeing a doctor, ask really pointed questions. Obviously, so many doctors have gone into the field and they really want to help people. And yet, we need to be well informed. And it's just like big government. When something gets so big, it can't answer all the questions. So we need to come back to community. We need to come back to ourselves and just sit for a moment and find out what the question is for us.
And try to find doctors who will listen to you and talk to you, because yes, I think practicing physicians are amongst the saddest victims,
exactly,
of the present system.
Sure.
Because they are at the mercy of what they are told by the FDA, and much of their information comes from drug company representatives.
And of course, the same thing is going on in the ag schools, where they're fed all of the information about how you need to be feeding the soils.
Yeah.
And it's all coming out now that a new direction is needed, and I think it is happening.
I hope so.
Henry, what years were you editor for the Society for Scientific Exploration's journal? It's a good place for a gathering of the denialists, and I'm wondering if you could let us know when you were involved and as an editor, and perhaps one or two of the research projects at that time that stood out for you or now that you're aware of.
I was editor from 2000 until 2007. I retired from teaching end of 1999, and they needed a new editor for the journal at that time, so I took it on. And then in 2003, 4, 5, I came across the HIV/AIDS thing. And eventually that became so much of a preoccupation that I had to resign from the editorship. The thing that I've found is so wonderful about the Society and about its journal is that it opened my mind in so many different ways, because I got to know people in the Society who were clearly honest, intelligent, competent people, and yet they were taking seriously things that I had never taken seriously myself. And so I began to listen to what they were saying and to look at the evidence they were presenting, and coming to realize that the sort of beliefs that we accumulate as we grow up without even much thinking about it are very often based on unfounded views.
Yes. Always a good reminder. It's amazing how much we just assume the world was flat once upon a time, right?
Right. Some time ago, I guess when I was writing one of my first books in this genre, it occurred to me that we often react with amazement and say about someone, how could anybody believe that? When actually that's the opposite is actually the interesting question. All of us are capable of believing anything at all,
exactly,
provided we've been imbued with it from an early enough age.
Exactly.
And the remarkable thing is that some people manage to get themselves out of that on some topics and to start thinking for themselves.
Right. I love the saying, hocus pocus, it's all where you focus.
Right.
Oh, that's wonderful. Henry, I'm not sure if I read that you were suggesting legislation could change some of this process, but I'm wondering, first of all, if that is true. But if you did have legislation, I think we're in this mess because of legislation. It's pretty much bought and paid for these days.
Right. But an honest, nonpartisan legislature could do a heck of a lot. One of the things that's wrong with the drug business, for example, is that the FDA is not properly funded. So they don't have the resources to properly test the claims that are being made when drugs are being presented for approval. The drug companies carry out the clinical trials. They don't have to produce the results of every clinical trial, only of the successful ones. And the drug companies pay the costs that the FDA incurs in doing the approval process. Well, 20 years ago, there was a process of accelerated approval introduced, which was because of the panic about AIDS. But nowadays, every drug is being submitted under this accelerated approval, which only requires a test of 6 months, two trials of 6 months duration, which obviously aren't enough to pick up side effects and so on, or sure. even to test efficacy properly. Now, the legislation that required the drug companies to pay for the approval process specifically said that they were not to use the funds for monitoring the actual effects of the drug once it came on the market. And yet that's absolutely essential when you have drugs approved after such short trials. Mm. And one result of that that you can see is that an increasing number of drugs have to be withdrawn from the market after less and less time out because very serious side effects show up so soon after they come on the market. So legislation could help if they would fund the FDA properly and make the drug companies pay for post-market monitoring as well as for just the technicalities of looking at the original approval process.
Henry, you're such a valuable resource in this field, and I'm wondering, is there something that we've missed? I've so much appreciated your clarity in all of this. It's just wonderful.
I mean, as far as I can tell, we've covered the main points of not only the talk I gave, but, you know, the more general aspects that are in this book, Dogmatism in Science and Medicine. I don't have anything that it occurs to me to add at the moment, but feel free to get in touch again.
Well, I appreciate that so much. And what is your website that people could connect to see what you're up to?
It's henryhbauer.homestead.com.
Henry, I appreciate your time today and for all of the wonderful work you're doing in the world. Your students were quite lucky to have you for all those years.
Well, Robin, thank you very much.
Many thanks to Henry Bauer for his openness and curiosity and for sharing with us today. For any guest information, to listen to archives and share resources, it's tributariesradio.wordpress.com. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for staying tuned.